I'm Carrie Thompson, and you're listening to a special edition of Playback. This month, we take a visit to the NPR archives with a very special tour guide, a woman affectionately known as the mother of public radio, NPR's Susan Stamberg.
When I listen back to this early stuff, I sound a whole lot younger, and it doesn't sound as if I was smoking as many cigarettes as, in fact, I was in those days. Now it sounds that way, but it didn't then. And I sound a little more tentative and a little more careful, I think, than I do now. But I was more tentative and careful then.
After all, it was nearly 40 years ago, and NPR had been on the air for 1 month. Welcome to First File, an occasional series we'll feature on Playback that explores the backstory behind some legendary NPR broadcast debuts. We'll ask tough, probing questions of our first filers. Questions like, what was it like to hear your voice on the air for the first time? And what were some of the reactions when your story aired? And what really went on in that fourth floor edit booth? It is not an exaggeration to say that NPR was a wild and woolly place back in June of 71. Take a listen to the introduction of Susan's story by the very first All Things Considered host, Robert Conley.
In Washington, the Yippie leader, Abbie Hoffman, pleaded not guilty to federal charges that he incited and took part in a riot during the recent May Day Week demonstrations in the nation's capital. He appeared briefly before a United States district judge, and Mr. Hoffman, Abbie Hoffman, was indicted by a grand jury.
That's Robert Conley, host of ATC from May to July of 1971. His rather short tour of duty was followed by two intermittent replacements until Susan Stamberg became co-host with Mike Waters in 1972. In doing so, she became the first woman to host a major network news program.
I was ambitious from day one for this network. I knew what the implications were for it, and I knew it would become something enormous. We had no resources in the beginning. We started literally almost on shoestrings, tin cans and strings. A handful of five reporters, almost no resources, and this tiny number of stations. But we were ambitious from the beginning, and we knew we were into something that was going to be very important.
Yep. And the facts clearly bear this out, because here we are, 40 years later, talking about the start of public radio and living the dream. Here's NPR broadcast librarian Joella Straley in her official Playback First File, talking to Susan Stamberg.
So I was curious about the first long piece that you ever filed for NPR. May Day of 1971, there was a large anti-war protest here in Washington. As many as 50,000 people came out for that. They blocked traffic, they put cars in the street and garbage and things like that. Many, many thousands of arrests were made during that. And you spoke to an attorney, Philip Hirschkopf, who represented a bunch of those people who were arrested. We wanted to play just a little clip from that interview and then ask you what it was like to speak with him.
What kinds of charges were leveled against them?
Well, mostly with disorderly conduct charges, incommoding a sidewalk, failure to move on. There were some what we call U.S. charges, which are prosecuted by the U.S. Attorney's Office here in D.C., of unlawful entry. The people at the Capitol arrested on May 5th, a little over 1,000 people, were charged with unlawful entry.
The D.C. Corporation Counsel, C. Francis Murphy, dropped something like 2,500 cases. And so far there have been 10, haven't there, people who've been convicted?
Yes.
What's the present situation then?
Well, there are still about another 2,000 or 3,000 coming out of May 3rd.
Monday,
yeah, to be prosecuted. Of those, maybe a few hundred.
So that was you and Philip Hirschkopf back in the day.
It was mostly Philip Hirschkopf. And he was this lively. I mean, he was just a dynamo. This was an age of great agitation on the streets. I mean, that war in Vietnam was beginning to wind down, but the anti-war protests were not. And those kids, and they were mostly young people with a lot of hair, long hair and beards, were determined on the 3rd of May to shut down the federal government. And so it was wild, and these are sweep arrests in the Nixon administration, and they found in Philip Hirschkopf an activist lawyer who was going to defend them to the death. And he was extremely successful. He was so successful and so intriguing, and he was a lot in the news in those days, that not too long after, a few weeks later, I decided I really wanted to spend more time with him. Because of the liveliness of his personality, but also because it was a real issue those days, these cowboy lawyers who would just sort of launch in and take on causes, always liberal causes, helping the hippies and the yippies and the everybody else who was out there sort of screaming on the streets. And so I asked if I could spend the day with him to create a kind of profile. He agreed to this, and so I hauled my tape recorder and microphone out. And in those days, it was either reel-to-reel tape recording, which you haven't seen in your lifetime, I don't think. Or
we have them down in the archive.
Oh, yeah, yes, right. And you blow the dust off them, and maybe they'll still work. Or a really heavy cassette recorders. It was one or the other, but I didn't care what it weighed.
I was actually curious to know how much your reporter kit had weighed.
Yeah, that thing must have weighed at least 10 pounds, maybe more, the cassette recorder. So I was awfully glad to give it up, although I didn't want to give it up right away. Anyway, I hauled that thing off, and these were the days when cinema verite was being shown with great excitement in movie theaters. We know today this sort of reality TV, but all of that is posed, and it's all sort of rehearsed, and it's faked reality. But cinema verite was real life being captured by cameras that rolled all the time and then cut and created into documentaries of real life. And that's what my idea was to do with Philip Hirschkopf, create sort of the radio verite version of it.
At the top of the piece, you say that you had your recorder running for 5 hours, and then we'll hear the distillation of that.
That's right. And so that's exactly what I did. I must have come back with at least that much tape. And then cut it down. And my goal was to have no narration, but let the sound tell the story, mm-hmm. the events of the day, just edited together in what I hope would be a skillful fashion.
Now, there was one little part of that I thought we could play because it seems to illustrate what it would have been like to be a reporter for NPR in the early days when people weren't so aware, maybe hadn't even heard of it before. There's a little aside that he makes to his client. It's kind of off mic, but you can hear it.
This young lady is taping for a show. Anything you tell me will be confidential. I won't let her use it unless we agree that she uses it. Do you mind if she have her turn tape recorder on?
I don't think this is worth it. So not only does he call you a young lady.
Well, I was then. It's a sort of old tape.
But I think people don't use young lady so much anymore, do they?
Oh, that's right. That's very good. That was an artifact. And I'm sure, you know, when I do that, it's because I don't remember the person's name. And mm-hmm. it certainly may be that he didn't in that moment.
But he also says, he also doesn't mention the name of the show or even say, this young lady is taping for NPR, which I think people would be more apt to say now. You know, he's not aware of the group that you come from. And I know that when I call people and say I'm calling from NPR, I get better treatment than I would if I was calling from whatever unknown, you know, newspaper or something like that. Was it difficult to get interviews with people then? Or
it certainly was. Now we've got people, top people in the administration calling here and mm-hmm. asking for the chance to be on our air. In the beginning, yes, you had to do at least a 60-second tap dance with every phone call. Hello, I'm Susan Stamberg. I'm calling from National Public Radio. We're a brand-new network of stations, public radio stations, non-commercial FM across the country, and we would like a chance to talk with you for our evening broadcast. It goes on the air at 5 o'clock. You mm-hmm. just sort of went on and on. And sometimes, if you got lucky, they would say yes. Mm-hmm. But Hirschkopf liked publicity, and he liked attention. Uh-huh. And also, I had known him already. You know, I had interviewed him that once, so he, at that point, did know mm-hmm. who we were, and it was for the cause. You know, it was, these were things that he believed in, the kinds of people he was defending.
What does the law say? Do you have that law?
Yeah, listen, just listen.
Do you notice that it's a 35-mile zone, you're going 60?
I'm doing 35, my speedometer. Come on, where are you, Susan? Do you believe I was raised in the country? Yeah, I'm a country boy.
Where were you raised?
Hightstown, New Jersey. So I was just a city slicker. I'm just a country lawyer. Plying my wares. How else are we doing, Nancy? Where are the four statues? So far, you've only read me two statues. You wait out here with that. Phil Hirschkopf. Turn that thing off, will you?
You see how... You see how, what a wheeler-dealer kind of guy he was, but I'm amazed at how audacious I was, too. And that was part of the radio verite business, that you were out there to capture the moment, and whatever happened in the moment, you named it for your listener so that you could point up to them, get their attention to something that he was doing. But you can also tell we were both having an awfully good time.
It sounds like it.
Yeah. So and essentially, the piece ran something, it was like that. And from those 5 hours, I cut it into about 15 minutes. The format was never any different. It was just moment after moment, fading in, fading out, or spliced throughout the day. And it ran. And there was a fellow, an excellent documentarian and reporter on our staff named Josh Darsa, who was in charge of us that day, or production of pieces like this or something. I think this thing went on the air, as was our habit in those days, without anyone except myself having heard it. So there it was. I mean, we had editors, certainly, but we had none of the layers of safety nets that we do now. Just whoever was producing the thing did it, handed it over maybe 2 seconds before airtime, and it got on the air. So this ran, and I got a phone call later that evening from Mr. Josh Darsa, and he says, "Susan, you need to come in quite early tomorrow morning. I have to talk to you." And he sounded very stern, and he had one of these deep voices. So I, shaking in my sandals, went in to see him the next day, and he said, "This was not a report. What you did here were elements of things that you could have used in bits and pieces with narrative in between to take our hand through the day with this person and tell us, not just make us do all of this work." And I said, but, what do you mean? I mean, it was, my idea was radio verite. Let the thing tell the story. Let the events of the day tell the story. No, certainly not. I don't think so at all. These were things that could have been used as little moments and sound effects to a report you wrote. So just very abashed, feeling terrible. I creeped away with my tail between my legs and have felt awful about this piece ever since, until you kindly provided me with a CD of it, and I listened to it the other day. I think he was dead wrong. I think that it really sings. I mean, I get the sense, just as a radio listener now, not the one who produced it, that I'm interested, I'm compelled. Sometimes I'm lost, which is a good thing in this piece, because it makes me listen harder to see where we're going next time and what he's busy and what he's involved with. So we were inventing this kind of radio.
Were you doing a lot of 15-minute pieces along the lines and other reporters?
You bet. We did. We all did. They were extremely long. Some were far too long. This one was probably too long, too. But in many ways, it held up. And the point is, it was all so experimental then. You could try anything. You could think, hey, why don't I? And go out and try it.
How many stations do you think were carrying All Things Considered at the time of this?
We had 70 member stations.
Okay. That was it. So some people were hearing it.
Maybe we had 70 listeners. I don't know.
That's wonderful. You became host of All Things Considered in 1972. Is that right? And you were the first female national head of a national broadcast.
Yes.
Correct. So what were people's opinions about that? I mean, how was that received?
Not terribly well, but I didn't know it at the time. Something like 12 years later, I learned from a man named Bill Siemering, who really was our first program manager and the fellow who conceived of All Things Considered, that after I started, there were a number of complaints from managers of our stations, saying that a woman's voice was not authoritative enough, that I would not be taken seriously as a presenter of news because this was so unusual for somebody to do. And he didn't tell me, and deliberately did not, until those many years passed, because he had great confidence in me and my ability to do the job, and he felt that if he told me, it would throw me in some way, and it would affect my presentation, my performance, essentially. And I hope he was right. That is, over time, and fairly quickly, the objections disappeared, and people were very, first of all, enthused about it, and then very enthused about it. So I got to keep that job for an awfully long time.
Seems like it worked out pretty well.
Yeah, I guess it worked out.
There were a lot of women here in the early days. Is
you
that
bet.
True? I've heard it said there really was nowhere else to work if you wanted to be in broadcast journalism.
Still true.
Yeah. Did you want to work in any other network, or were you really sold on working in public radio?
Well, in those days, public radio was so low profile. And I would get offers from time to time, particularly from the commercial television networks. But every time I thought about it, I could see that there was simply no point in doing it, except for money, which, if I'd been interested in that, I wouldn't have been in public radio from the get-go. There was no chance to really develop ideas, tell stories at length, tell them in depth. That was not anybody's priority, really, but ours.
An in-depth look at Susan Stamberg's first file with NPR's Joella Straley. To hear a full excerpt of Susan's first file, her interviews with lawyer Philip Hirschkopf, go to our blog, As a Matter of Fact, at npr.org. Playback will return next month with a glimpse of the wild shenanigans of August 1984. Special thanks for this first file edition of Playback go to Michael Katziff, Robert Speer, and Maureen Clements. I'm Carrie Thompson, and you're listening to Playback.
Here he comes.
I am going to the bathroom.
Wonderful.
You and that tape recorder aren't going to the bathroom with me when I go to the bathroom. And from there, we're going to get a sandwich, because among the many functions I perform, I eat.
So the judge did what you predicted he'd do.
Oh, without any question. It was no use going there making long arguments when it's foregone conclusion.
How do you react to this? So you're putting in an awful lot of time, which you could predict would be wasted effort.
It's all, building an end result.
Yesterday, Hirschkopf won the Brad Little case. There was a new judge, new evidence, including the Life magazine photographs, and the charges of assault were dismissed. Tomorrow, he goes to Roanoke to represent a college teacher who claims he's being punished by his college for writing a letter to the editor of Red Book magazine, praising an article they'd published on premarital sex. Philip Hirschkopf is a very busy man. This is Susan Stamberg.